Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 59. My name is Karen. Your name is...
Kristen.
Welcome, everybody.
Welcome back.
We are post-Thanksgiving.
And we promise this episode will be shorter.
Yes. Yeah, no, this episode is definitely going to be shorter than last week's.
It got a little long, but we just had a lot to say.
Yeah, I don't know what we were thinking. We're always like, no, this shouldn't be too... This is an easy episode to do.
And it was
later.
Fun and easy, but then yeah. We also had a blog post and a quiz and a really, like, pretty dense chapter, and so it just made for a very, very long episode, which hopefully you all enjoy. Some people like long episodes of the podcast, and some people are like, no, an hour and I'm out. Like,
we did a poll once, and people liked it on the longer side.
Well, that's good. I hope everybody enjoyed it.
And if you don't, you can always, like, take an intermission break in the middle.
It's why we've got the three-section thing going on. Yeah. If you... You know, you can only get through one section. That's cool. I get it.
Exactly. If you would like to contact us, you can do so at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. Also, because I'm between books right now, I'm going to take a little time. I'm going to hype up our Tumblr a little bit. I'm going to try to be a little more active in the Percy Jackson fandom, and I have an article coming out soon, so keep an eye on Subjectify Media for that.
That's exciting.
Yeah. I want to get into our news, though. There's not much here. I mean, it was just Thanksgiving in the States, so I feel like it makes
sense. It's like one of those weeks where everybody kind of just takes a break. Yeah. TV takes a break, everything takes a
break. Yeah. I was like, why... Do I have no emails in my inbox? Why is nobody responding to me? I messaged people on Wednesday, and I was like, oh, yeah. Because a lot of people are out of the office, like, either all this week or, like, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, that makes more sense. Stop bothering people, Karen. Just because you want to be productive the day before Thanksgiving doesn't mean everybody else does.
The majority of the world looks at it and goes, no.
Yeah, exactly. But Reed Riordan did put up a post this week titled, What Are the Gods and Demigods Thankful For This Year? And it was a pretty good spread. We got Percy Jackson, Leo, Athena, Persephone, Demeter, Meg, Apollo, Sally, Leo again, and Nyx. Nyx rounded it out, which I thought was very interesting.
That's cool.
That was a pretty cool blog post, and I always like these ones because it's kind of like, it's not canon because time doesn't move if Rick isn't writing a book, you know? Like, that's why Percy Jackson has been 17 for how many years?
Yes.
But it's also still like, oh, we're checking in on certain people, and like Leo especially because, like, spoiler alert for this article... Leo was going to finally go see Calypso, and then Calypso canceled on him again, and he was kind of bummed. And it's like, you kind of get to see that, like, they're still not together. They're still, like, working out their relationships. So
yeah, that's fun.
Kind of interesting, but yeah. We also got a couple of things from Becky this week as well. The first one is that recently Mark had gone to some sort of book convention of sorts.
Yeah, it wasn't one that I recognized the name of, but...
I think it was for, like, teachers and educators.
That sounds
so right.
So
maybe more like a conference than a convention. And they had samplers for The Sun and the Star, and some people got their hands on some. And it was going around that part of the dedication was to Piper, so people are kind of speculating that Piper might play a larger role in this book. But really it was for, he dedicated it to all the Nikos, Wills, and Pipers in the world, you know, people who are queer. And I really loved that. But then people kept asking, okay, will we be able to get our hands on these sample chapters? And Becky said, great question. When will a sample chapter be available? Answer, the bound samples that we were showing were from a very small printing that went out to select groups. I'm pretty sure we'll see at least a partial sample chapter at some point on Reed Riordan well before May 2nd. And Reed Riordan usually does put up, like, either the first chapter or part, like an excerpt from a chapter or something like that. So keep an eye out for that. Don't know if we'll be getting, you know, more physical copies out in the world, but at least we can look forward to an excerpt on Reed Riordan.
Mm-hmm.
And then the book also went up on bookshop.org, I think it was, and we got some information about the physical copy. It is going to be 480 pages long. That's a pretty big book.
It is.
And I mean, I would say like the Trials of Apollo books were probably in the 450 to 500 range, I'm pretty sure. They tended to be a little bit on the big side, so I mean, we already know it was like 119,000 words, I think he said.
Yeah.
So, yeah, 480, pretty good size book. Lots of stuff can happen between page 1 and page 480, so
yeah.
We'll see what that ends up being, but I'm pretty excited. I have a lot of trouble reading big books. Like, my brain just can't sit down for that long. Tend to like shorter, faster-paced books, but these are the exception. I'll read a 500, 600, 700-page book from Rick Riordan. That's not going to be a problem.
Yeah. Nope, I hear you.
That's it for the news. Pretty quick.
Hey!
Yeah.
Yep, that's what happens for when you have Thanksgiving. It does kind of knocks down some of the craziness. But that's good, because last week we had quite a bit, so it takes a minute.
All right, so let's move into our discussion for today. So like we said last week, we were going to do a monster guide on pit scorpions, but like I warned you guys, there's not a whole lot going on with pit scorpions, so I kind of chose some random things to talk about here because scorpions and Greek mythology do go together. Pit scorpions is kind of like a generic term, though. You see it a lot in games like RuneScape and Magic the Gathering, and we also know that Rick used to play D&D, so this kind of feels like a nod to that a little bit.
Yeah.
So I actually really liked that he included them, but I did find that in terms of scorpions, there's one bigger story, one bigger myth about Scorpios and Orion, and I actually don't think I had heard this before, which is interesting because when we think of, like, constellations and stuff, and we'll get into that in a minute, like Orion's belt is one of the ones that's very easy to pick out of the sky and kind of know a little bit about him being like a hunter and stuff like that, but I didn't realize the relationship between Scorpios and Orion. Had you heard of this before at all, or
no? Like, okay. I know how to find Orion and his belt in the sky, but like, I other than like Men in Black, I don't really know like a whole lot about Orion. Like, you know, I've heard movies have incorporated some part of the tale or whatever in there, so there may be things that are familiar, but I don't think I've ever actually heard the story.
There are a lot of different versions of this myth, but the one that I kind of liked the most and also thought was a little more relevant to Percy Jackson was Hesiod said that Orion went away to Crete and spent his time hunting in company with Artemis and Leto. It seems that he threatened to kill every beast there was on Earth, whereupon, in her anger, Gaia sent up against him a scorpion of a very great size, by which he was stung and so perished. After this, Zeus, at the prayer of Artemis and Leto, put him among the stars because of his manliness, and the scorpion also as a memorial of him and of what had occurred. And this is from Theoi.com, by the way, and I kind of looked up some other versions of this as well, and some describe it as Artemis being the one who sends Scorpios after Orion. He, like, held on to the hem of her, like, dress or something like that, and, you know, she's a virgin goddess, so that was a big no-no. And other ones, and so she was the one who sent Scorpius after Orion. Other people say that Apollo was angry at what Orion had done, and he was the one that sent Scorpius. So you know, pretty basic, pretty interesting, though. He was a great hunter, and he was like, I'm gonna kill every monster on the planet, and someone was not happy about that. So, Scorpios was one that he could not defeat.
Got it.
And the interesting thing for me, at least, actually for both of us, is that the two opponents are never seen in the sky, so their constellations are never seen in the sky at the same time, for as one constellation rises, the other sets. The ancient Greek Scorpios originally encompassed two constellations. Scorpio formed its body and Libra its claws. And I'm a Scorpio.
And I'm a Libra.
And I was like, that is so cute.
That is.
And I love, like, I actually had no idea that Scorpios was a separate constellation from the Scorpio, like, zodiac constellation, and that it encompassed both Libra and Scorpio, which makes sense because you were born in October, right? Kind of at the cusp, right? Like, aren't you?
I'm right at the beginning of October.
No, I mean for the zodiacs.
Oh, yeah, I think, yeah.
Because my mom was born in October, and one of my best childhood friends was born both late October, and they're both Scorpios.
Right.
So Libra leads into Scorpio, which, you know, makes sense, I think.
Also, I'm kind of, like, thinking about, I mean, I don't know what the actual constellation looks like, but if you kind of think of, like, the scorpion and the two claws, mm-hmm. and, like, that would kind of fit with the Libra side of things, you know? And then, like, the tail being more of, like, a scorpion.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I could see if the constellation faces that way, like, that would totally make sense.
It would, yeah. definitely. And another fun fact I just learned is that, so Greek mythology, the Scorpius constellation is there in Greek mythology. That's the same constellation as Maui's fish hook.
Interesting.
In that mythology. So they just look at it a different way, call it something else. But now I feel all special.
Right.
That we help make up the fish hook constellation.
That's so cool.
Yeah. I was really happy about that.
Maui.
Yeah. So that was super neat. And I hadn't, like, you know, I'm going to admit this live on air. Like, I'd never really thought of other people's views of the same constellations and how they might look at it different and call it something different.
Right. Yeah, not me either.
And, you know, I'm glad that this is broadening my horizons. It's a little celestial joke for you.
Nice punnage, yes.
And now I really want to look into, like, you know, the same constellation but interpreted different ways and what stories come from that. I feel like that could be very interesting.
Yeah.
The Scorpio zodiac sign specifically is associated with death and rebirth, which makes sense. You know, Orion was killed by a scorpion. He was reborn into the stars. I feel like that makes sense. Scorpions are deadly.
Mm-hmm.
And it is also ruled by the planet Pluto, aka Hades, the god of the underworld. So we have, like, a lot of full circle stuff here, a lot of symbolism that just kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I love astrology and astronomy and all of that kind of stuff, so I really wanted to include that. There is another myth that sort of ties into this one. I got this from Wikipedia. Ovid writes that Phaethon, the son of Helios, who boasted of his relationship to the god, he asked for proof, and Helios swore on the river Styx to grant him whatever he wanted. Phaethon then asked to drive the sun chariot, and though Helios told him it was too dangerous, he finally relented. Phaethon describes driving the chariot across the sky, having to avoid the beasts among the stars, including Scorpio's cruel pincers sweeping out to encircle you from one side, and Cancer's crab claws reaching out from the other. But in the end, he could not control it. The horses veered from their path and scorched the earth, and Phaethon fell from the sky. Jupiter was then forced to intervene and strike Phaethon down with a lightning bolt. And so when you think of the sun chariot getting too close to the earth, it scorches the earth and all that kind of stuff. This myth is apparently used to explain the dark skin of the Ethiopians and the deserts of Africa, which I love when stories try to explain, you know, how those things come about. I also thought it was very interesting that Ovid specifically says Jupiter instead of Zeus, because Phaethon is from Greek mythology, Helios is from Greek mythology, but Jupiter is mentioned here instead of Zeus because Ovid was a Roman poet, and I think Helios is one of those ones that translates over. Don't quote me on that. I don't actually know that for sure, but yeah, just kind of interesting that he would say Jupiter instead of Zeus, but very much within Zeus's / Jupiter's character to strike somebody down with a lightning bolt.
Really? Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. But, I mean, in terms of Greek mythology, that is really all I found. After doing a very quick search, I'm sure there's probably other mentions or maybe other smaller stories, but Scorpios is pretty much the big one when you want to talk about scorpions.
I mean, that makes sense. We know there's a lot of things about spiders, there's a lot of things, you know, so, like, each creature kind of has their one or two, like, big things, but then I'm sure there are probably 100 or 1,000 spider stories that don't have anything to do with Athena or don't have anything, you know, that are... It's hard to, like, nail all of that down. But yeah, no, I think this is a fun look at the scorpion in Greek mythology.
And we learned some new things.
Yeah.
Some fun facts that maybe we could pull out at trivia or something like that.
Right? Like, Moana, Maui, you're welcome.
Yeah.
It's all a part. I think that's cool.
It's really fun. I like it. So, in Percy Jackson, the pit scorpion is described as about the size of a person's hand. It can jump 15 feet, which, I mean, that is a lot.
Nope.
That is a lot.
Nope. That better be a 20-foot pit.
Yeah. After a person is stung, a red well instantly appears, oozing yellow pus. Next, sound begins to fade and vision is blurred. Then comes loss of movement and loss of vision. Paralysis soon follows, then unconsciousness, then ultimately death, unless the wound is treated immediately. And this takes place in only about 60 seconds time. So you have 1 minute to be treated for this. And of course, we saw this at the end of The Lightning Thief when Luke comes out and basically has a pit scorpion there. He disappears. Percy goes for his sword. The scorpion jumps, stings him, even though Percy does kill the scorpion, and he kind of runs out to the edge of the trees, and I think it was the dryads find him, I'm pretty sure.
I think so, yeah.
And so they did not have very long to heal him, you know, that was...
Yeah.
It's a good thing he could run as fast as he could. Otherwise, he definitely would have been dead.
I was going to say, it probably also helps that he's a god of the sea, because I'm sure they were probably able to use water to help treat him or something. You know what I mean?
Maybe,
like, it probably helps. Like, if you were god of war, like, it might not be as easy to heal you, but because he has water kind of as a part of his being, that it might be easier to treat wounds and that sort of thing. So
wouldn't that be funny? Like, oh, I'm dying. Just go take a bath. You'll be fine.
Right.
You know?
You just need some salt water.
Yeah.
Drink this, you'll be fine. That is fine.
Gargling salt water would, like, instantly get rid of your cold. I hate salt water, but...
I mean...
I would do it if I could instantly get rid of a cold.
Right?
Yeah.
Same. So much same.
But yeah, I mean, you know, not to jump too far ahead, but the pit scorpion is, weirdly enough, mentioned in this chapter.
He is, yeah.
We did not plan that, by the way. Literally had no idea.
Part of me thought maybe you knew. Like, I was like, maybe she read ahead or something. Because as soon as I read that little portion, I kind of skipped right past it and then went, wait a minute.
Yeah.
We're talking about scorpions this week. Like, this is perfect. Yeah, totally kismet. Just
it was
worked.
Accident, just like the other week when everything lined up, this lined up, so that was really funny. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if pit scorpions are mentioned in, like, the battles in this book at all. I almost want to say they are. I didn't get any specific references from the Wikipedia. It just mentioned the lightning thief.
Mm-hmm.
But it also said that, like, during the battles, they were called forth or whatever. So,
okay. So we'll have to keep an eye out. Because I don't think we've heard anything from, like, the bridge yet. Like,
or
I don't think
they were in the Battle of the Labyrinth when they attacked at the end of the book, when they attacked camp.
Also possible.
I think there were some there, but I don't remember.
No, we'll have to keep an eye out for scorpions, because there's a lot of battles still to come in this book. So, like, there's a good possibility that we might see a scorpion or two.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like I said, that, you know, that's it.
Yep.
That's as much as we got. This discussion was really fast. We're at 20 minutes in the recording right now. I don't think this has literally ever happened. But that's okay, because I feel like there's a lot of really interesting things to talk about in our chapter for The Last Olympian this week. So, Kristen, take it away.
So, yes, we are up to chapter 13, entitled A Titan Brings Me a Present. So, a Hyperborean, a Half-Blood, an Impusa, and Prometheus walk onto a playground. Just kidding. But anyway, seriously, they did. And they walk up with a white flag, and Prometheus singles Percy out to have a quick parley on a picnic table. Prometheus starts by telling Percy how overwhelmed his forces will be if they don't surrender now. Like, outnumbered 20-1 overwhelmed. Percy makes a dig about their spy, but Prometheus just keeps on moving forward, trying to convince Percy to give up the fight. Prometheus then mentions that he is the Titan of Forethought, and that he has seen what is going to happen. Grover then reminds Percy that Prometheus is also the Titan of Crafty Counsel, which is a really specific thing to be a Titan of, if you ask me. Just throwing that out there. The Titan then goes on to remind Percy that Kronos' war is with the gods. He promises that Kronos will spare New York City, and all of the Half-Bloods fighting with Percy will be granted amnesty. All they have to do is let Kronos march into Olympus and take the throne room. Talia exclaims that she and the hunters will fight to the last breath, and Prometheus credits her bravery, but also reminds her of her humanity by using her surname, Grace. Talia is less than thrilled with the Titan's manipulation. Percy and Ethan then have an exchange about how Ethan can't be happy with what Prometheus is offering because it doesn't give him the revenge that he's after. Ethan counters that what he wants is respect, but Percy parries his response with some quips about how his mother Nemesis doesn't usually stand for fairness. I mean, Percy saved his life, and Ethan repaid his debt to Percy by raising Kronos. Percy kinda has a point. And then, as if Prometheus could see the cogs turning in Percy's head, he puts together that Percy is upset about Luke's fate and all this, and decides that if Percy knew the whole tale, he would feel differently. Then the Titan presses his finger to Percy's forehead, and Percy is thrust into a vision. He's in May Castellan's living room, and Hermes and Luke are having a heated exchange, while Annabeth and Talia are hanging in the kitchen with an addled May Castellan. They fight about how Hermes has been an absent father, and how Hermes wishes he could do more, but that he cannot interfere in his child's life, especially since he knows Luke's fate. Hermes hints that he can see what lies ahead for Luke, but seems to want to do good things for him before that, including getting him into Camp Half-Blood, allowing him to be a hero before his inevitable turn. Luke resists and marches out the front door with Annabeth and Talia on his heels. Percy then wakes from his vision, and Grover can feel the anger welling in his soul. Percy is reminded by Prometheus of many instances in which the gods have done wrong by mankind and by the Titans, including Zeus taking his anger out on Maria D'Angelo, Hades cursing the Oracle, Hermes failing to help Luke in any truly meaningful way, and so on. Prometheus then plops a large vase on the table with a lid strapped down on it. It's Pandora's storage jar, and the only spirit remaining inside is Elpis, the spirit of hope. If Percy wishes to surrender to Kronos, all he has to do is give up hope by opening the jar, and Prometheus promises that Kronos will spare the survivors.
A lot of, like, exposition and discussion and, like, back and forth in terms of dialogue, but still a very dynamic chapter.
Agreed. There's a lot of, it's literally just them talking, but there's a lot of information and back and forths in this that are important to talk about, so. We can start by just kind of taking stock of who is present. So it's the Hyperborean is the giant of the north, and he is kind of leaning against a tree nearby. Ethan Nakamura is there, kind of standing, I think, behind Prometheus, like, listening, but also not, like, directly involved. The Impusa was sent to a bench because she was misbehaving. And then Prometheus is there as well. So then Percy is talking one-on-one with Prometheus, but Talia and Grover are behind him, kind of, again, helping.
Yeah.
And being involved in the discussion.
Yeah. Okay. I also have to point out that Grover has the same phobia of bunnies that Anya from Buffy does.
Okay, first of all, the first time I read this, I had not seen Buffy.
Yeah.
So, like, it has a totally different, like, thing now. Yeah. Like, it's kind of funny to think of both of them being afraid of bunnies.
It's so
silly.
He's sad because what do they do? Do they steal the carrots from satyrs or...
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So, and I think that Anya just found it very disconcerting that they procreated a lot and, like, their little beady eyes and their little noses, like...
Yeah.
Yeah, it was...
I remember the beady little eyes comment. Yeah, for
so
sure.
So funny and random.
It is.
It also made me sad because the ice giant reminded Percy of Tyson and he didn't want to fight him.
Like, It was so cute. Like, yeah. The ice giant is really just kind of, like, big and simple and kind yeah. of, you know, a little, I would say even a little simpler than Tyson. Tyson has a little more going on, I think, than the a giant does. But, like, he doesn't seem vicious or violent.
No. Although, a whole bunch of teddy bears.
And... although we do hear from Talia that you don't want to get into, what, a snowball fight with them? Like, so clearly she's come up against these guys and is like, well, when they're fighting you, it's not good. Yeah. But,
I didn't know if that meant an actual fight or if they were like, hey, do you want to play, you know, I have a snowball fight? And then, like, their snowballs are the size of boulders and...
I mean, they probably could go either way. I just assumed she meant, like, we fought these guys and, like... You don't want to get in a snowball fight, right? Like, I thought she was being funny.
I find it very interesting that the giants and Percy Jackson, you know, whether it's a Cyclops or it's something else, they can be bad, but, like, at least half the time, it seems, they're, like, kind of okay, or they're just... they happen to be on the side of bad, but, you know, somebody just kind of points them in a direction and says, go fight. Whereas, like, in a lot of other places, you know, giants are, like, evil. Like, they're not good creatures. And I just like that we kind of see a little bit of both sides of that in Percy Jackson. I find it kind of interesting.
Yeah, you know, it's like Jack and the Beanstalk, where the giants are all just evil. They're right. bad. They're up yeah. there, and they want to eat all the little... things and people.
I was thinking too, I think Game of Thrones, there are good giants because I think the men of the North were like fighting alongside one of them.
They have giants.
Yeah.
Well, and like even in like Harry Potter,
they're kind of
neutral, but then they join up with whatever side has what the best thing to offer them. Right. Like, you know, so they're not necessarily good or bad, but they can go either way.
Right. Yeah.
Giants are an interesting breed of, like, magical creature person, because they usually are at least humanoid, but...
I assume there's giants in Lord of the Rings?
I know they existed at one point. I think once we reach Middle Earth, there aren't any more giants. But, like, there are statues of the giants that existed in previous, like, times.
Okay.
So, like, and the statues, I think in some cases the statues are the giants. They've just fossilized, Yeah, so I know there are definitely, like... and then there's, like, Tom Bombadil, which I've never understood because I didn't read the books. I only saw the movies. I'm sorry. Don't yell at me. But, like, I never really understood what the whole Tom Bombadil thing is because he didn't make the movie. Like, they weren't able to put him really into the movie. There's some of his vibe is in there, but the actual character didn't make the movie. So, like, I never truly understood that. But I think that has something to do with, like, giants and trees and nature and... okay. Yeah. So, anyway... but yeah, there were definitely giants at one point, but just not in the main story.
Interesting.
Yeah, all the giant talk. Okay. So then they're having a chat, and Prometheus is there to offer... basically, he's offering them a white flag to wave. Like, say, all right, it's time. You should surrender. We've got you outnumbered 20-1. There's no chance you're going to win this. And Kronos, I'm telling you that Kronos is going to let everybody live... except for the gods, that he's going to basically already have killed by Typhon, who's fighting them right now, and they're just going to walk into the throne room and claim it, take it, and be done with it. And Percy is not... like, he it's not that he doesn't see what Prometheus is saying throughout this conversation. Like, he's hearing Prometheus out and listening and actually taking it in, but he is against Kronos so much that there's just no way he can really... even consider surrendering right. here.
I really liked Prometheus. He is very polite. He is very rational. I believe what he's saying. I believe that he believes what he's saying. It's not like he's lying about anything. Everything he says is true. It's just a different side to what we've seen from Percy's point of view. And... I have more to say about this later, I think. But yeah, I really enjoyed his character because he was a very calm presence, and you could see why he was sent as the peace envoy.
Yeah. Well, and Prometheus starts talking about, like, all the things that he's helped mankind. He brought mankind fire. He's had his thumb on the pulse of mankind and been helping them all this time. But, you know, that's when Grover kind of steps in and says, you say that you're this, but, like... you also are a manipulative titan, and I don't know how much we can trust what you're telling us here. And it makes sense. Like, Percy is having trouble kind of conflating what Prometheus is saying with what... If you're saying these things, how are you on Kronos' side?
Right.
Yes, you may have an argument with the gods, but an argument doesn't mean war and they need to be wiped out. Like, I think Percy is having trouble conflating the two and making them work together.
Right.
Okay, so after they're basically just talking it all out. Prometheus then offers an advancement to humankind that will move them as far forward as fire did. But only if the gods are defeated, because they definitely won't allow such a thing.
Right.
Like,
we didn't find out what this was.
No. Okay. He never actually says what the advancement is, but he just says, I have something I can give humankind that will jump you forward just as much as fire. And, like, you know, you start to wonder, like, what could that have been? Is it something we have? Is it, you know, information flow? Is it the, you know, what could he have given
because
humankind?
Because fire was, like, pivotal. Like, mankind would not be what it is if we did not have fire.
And fire is the...
Fire is what makes us humans in a lot of ways.
I was going to say, it's pivotal to so many chemical processes. Heating things and changing them is what allows humans to do so much. Yeah. Whether it's cooking, whether it's, you know, like folding steel and creating
weapons.
Buildings and weapons and, you know, all of that. Yeah. Like, there's so much that it all starts with heat. It starts with fire. So, yes, fire absolutely transformed the human experience.
Yeah.
And so, like, what could Prometheus possibly offer that would absolutely transform the human experience?
Yeah.
There's so many ways and things we can't even think of.
Yeah, I really can't fathom unless you're talking, like, jumping realities to visit, like,
right,
different, you know, planets or something. Like, it's got to be something so big that, like, it changes the entire trajectory of humankind.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't know if my brain can understand something that big.
And then there's the cynical part of me that wonders if Prometheus is even telling the truth.
I mean, that's fair. I want to believe him because I feel like he's genuine in everything else he's saying, but we have to remember that he can also be manipulative.
Yeah, because part of me is like, okay, he's telling Percy this, but then immediately after offering it, he says, but the gods have to be gone because they won't allow me to give it to you. And it's like, yeah, that's probably true, but... There's so many Greek stories about gods and things who do what they want anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, they usually have to deal with the consequences, but, like, Prometheus has some pretty nasty consequences already, so why wouldn't you? You know
right.
what I mean? Like, you can do it no matter what, so why aren't you doing it? Because you feel like it. You're trying, you know, he's trying to get something out of Percy, and it makes sense. But at the same time, I just wonder if he even has something to give humankind. I'm sure he does, but, like... You kind of, like, it's like, do you really even have anything that, like, what you're describing? Or is this all a ruse to try and prove to Percy that the gods are who's to blame for your lot in life? And it's not, it has nothing to do with the titans that are fighting with Kronos. It's definitely the gods. And we all know that you know, Percy does not see it that way.
Right.
Okay, so then he goes on to kind of try and give Percy a couple of examples of people and, I guess...
Beings?
Yeah, I was going to say, there's not really a good word for it, that have been wronged by the gods for no reason other than they exist, which one of the most, like, one of the biggest examples that Prometheus could provide is Calypso, who Percy has met and feels kinship with
mm-hmm.
in one form or another, and... You know, and Prometheus describes and says, like, she's the offspring of a titan of,
Atlas.
Yes, Atlas. And she didn't do anything wrong. She was born Atlas's daughter, and because of that, she was punished by the gods, and she doesn't deserve it, and this is why the gods are terrible. And it's like, okay, yeah, that is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But can't we, like, you know, maybe have a conversation?
Right?
Like, why is the only solution to this destroying the gods? Like, maybe we need to renegotiate. I don't know. So that pretty much wraps up that portion of the Prometheus-Percy conversation, because Percy leans toward Mr. Ethan Nakamura and says, you can't like this proposition, because if Prometheus, if we surrender and Prometheus gets what he's asking for, you don't get your revenge. And I have to say that this interchange between the two of them, it's chef's kiss perfect. Because every time Ethan thinks he's got it and is like, well, Percy, my mother is Nemesis. And Percy's like, yeah, well, Nemesis is all about revenge. And Ethan's like, no, she's about fairness. When someone has too much good luck, she evens it out. And Percy's like, yeah, like you even, you know, like every time Ethan comes up with something, Percy has the perfect comeback. And it's just, it just shows, like, how evenly matched these two are on, like, an intellectual level.
Yeah.
Like, we haven't seen a ton of Ethan, but from what we've seen, he's just so mad at the gods for, A, not giving respect to his minor god parent, but also, in general, with the gods disrespecting him as a half-blood as well. And seeing these two match up here, just, I love it.
I find it so interesting that you said that Percy always had a perfect, like, counterattack to Ethan, because I actually kind of saw it the opposite way. I thought Ethan kept up with Percy. He always had something to say when Percy, it was really the moment when he was like, your mother is the goddess of revenge. And he's like, no, she's the goddess of balance. And I was like, oh, like, that's a really good comeback, because if you really think about it, it does make sense. It's the whole, like, eye for an eye kind of thing. It is balancing things out. And, yeah, so, not that I was rooting for Ethan or anything, yeah, because I'm definitely rooting for Percy, but I agree with you. I think that these two are constantly butting heads, and Percy has given Ethan so many chances, and Ethan has dropped the ball, in my opinion, because we're obviously on Percy's side.
Yeah.
But to see them be equals in so many ways, I find fascinating. And it really makes you wonder what camp life would have been like with these two. If they would have become friends, even if they were like more like Clarice and Percy, if they were like frenemies, what that would have looked like, I think it would have been really interesting to see.
Agreed, yeah. I think the reason why I feel like Percy is the matcher, not like the person who's kind of like, yeah, is because when it's the part after that where Percy says, okay, well, what happened to your eye? And Ethan's like, well, it was payment for what is going to come for me. Like, my mother has promised me that if I do these things and I paid with my eye, that I'm going to get this. Like, his mother is Nemesis. So you're thinking that whole balance fairness thing that he just described. You're like, okay, so, you know, he gave an eye, so that must mean something important. And then Percy gets the jab, and it's my quote, I'm pretty sure, but it doesn't matter. I'll talk about it now anyway. It's the well, I saved your life, and you raised Kronos, so how are we even? Like, yeah, how are you a child of Nemesis living up to your mother when this is how you repay me for everything I've done for you? And that, I think, is where I'm like, yeah, get him, Percy. Come on! It's just so powerful, like, that is the truth. Like, at every turn, he has given Ethan a chance to look deeper at what's going on and see that Kronos is not the answer. Mm-hmm. The gods might not be the answer either, but they are going to be more reasonable than Kronos. And Ethan just can't see past his anger and can't get past what the gods have done.
Everyone on Kronos' side is kind of living under this illusion that Kronos is going to keep his word.
Right.
Like, if he does, then I can understand where they're coming from. But, like, if he does.
Yeah. And while I wouldn't necessarily always trust that Zeus is going to keep his word, there are also 11 other gods there to kind of try and help keep him in line. Like, Zeus can't just do everything he ever feels like, because he does have brothers that will bring some sort of punishment down on him if he does step too far out of line. Whereas Kronos doesn't really have anybody as big and powerful as him.
Right.
And so I feel like that, for me, that's where it gets off balance. Like, that's where Kronos just does not feel trustworthy to me. Whereas even if you don't trust Zeus, if you trust a Poseidon or a Hades or someone to keep him in line, then you've got a better chance at it, I feel
like. Right, yeah.
This basically leads to Prometheus looking at Percy and kind of putting some pieces together and saying, like, you seem to be really upset, and I think part of it is what happened with Luke, the raising of Kronos. And he says, I think if you understood the whole picture, you would be on our side. So he presses his finger to Percy's forehead, and poof, Percy is now in the middle of a vision.
Mm-hmm.
Does this count as a prophecy?
I would say so. I mean, okay, so it is a continuation of the previous one, mm-hmm. but it happens at a different time.
It does. And with a different initiation.
Yes. So I'm going to say prophecy count number 28.
I think that's fair. I think that's absolutely fair.
We are just making up these rules willy-nilly, by the way. We're just, you know, whatever it feels like in the moment, that's the rule.
We are Prophecy Radio, so we decide what a prophecy is in this book.
Yeah.
I mean, because technically it's a look back as well, but it's giving Percy insight into Luke, which is going to affect the future. So it is kind of a prophecy at the same time. So one of those fun, you know, the line is a little wiggly here, and we're just going with it. Okay, so he is now in this vision. He is in the Castellan house where he now, recognizes. And he sees Hermes and Luke fighting in the living room while Annabeth and Talia and May are in the kitchen. So we're basically focused on Hermes and Luke. And they're fighting about a lot of little things, but it all basically boils down to Luke is pissed that Hermes hasn't been present in his life and has chosen now to show up and tell him, like, I know better. I'm going to try and get you into camp. You should listen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And Luke is like, why should I? You might be my father, but you haven't been around. And now all of a sudden I'm supposed to just hear what you're saying and take it to heart.
Yeah.
And I don't blame him.
I don't either. And especially as a young kid, Luke, like, this is very formative for Luke, this moment and these years. And I honestly didn't expect Luke to have so much animosity toward his mom. That really surprised me. I mean, but it does make sense because he must have been so scared whenever she had her visions. And it, like, I don't want to say that it was necessarily an abusive relationship. I mean, I'm sure, like, intent versus non-intent matters a little bit. And, like, I can understand it being an abusive situation, but in a way where, like, his mom couldn't necessarily help it. And, like, she obviously has serious mental health issues that doesn't exclude her from that label. But it must have been so terrifying for him, so fearful to never know what version of his mom he was going to get. And you see that in a lot of kids with abusive parents.
Yeah, and I think I definitely get what you're saying. And I think she could be deemed abusive. But at the same time, I kind of think it's also maybe just like the definition of a toxic relationship. But she cannot work to make it untoxic.
Yeah,
like she's not capable of making it better.
Yes.
And so that is part of the, it's abuse, but it's not willful. It's, you know, it's happenstance. It's circumstantial. Yeah. She can't literally change herself and not be.
I think that's a pivotal point, actually, because she also can't just go to the hospital and get some meds and fix herself. This is magic. This is something only a god can fix, and Hermes isn't doing it.
Well, and I was trying to think, and stop me if I get too far ahead of myself. Do we ever actually learn how this came to be with her? Because I'm curious if this has something to do with Hades' curse.
I don't think so. I think she could see through the mist, like she had the sight. And however it came about, she could, because she has the green eyes like the Oracle does, but she's not an Oracle. And I think whatever it was that, like, Hermes was involved in, because Luke blames Hermes for what happened. Like, she saw something she shouldn't have. That's what it was. Hermes warned her not to keep looking.
Okay.
And she did anyway, and it broke her brain.
Well, because that was kind of, maybe I'm thinking of, like, a tangential relationship to the curse, because I'm curious if she maybe was in line to be an oracle in the line of succession, and because Hades cursed this oracle and she kept looking, she lost her mind. Like, if she had been next in line somehow, you know what I mean? That's kind of what I mean.
You are right. I don't remember when we learned this. It might be coming up, but I'll just say real quick right here, according to the wiki, Hermes told May about the oracle and how it couldn't take another host, but she believed she could take the spirit. And because of the curse and everything, the spirit was still trapped inside the original body. And so Hermes basically said it was going to be too dangerous, but she went ahead and tried to do it anyway. And I think that's what broke her brain.
So a little bit of both.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because for some reason, it felt like this had something to do with Hades and the curse. So that's, yeah, good to know. And I can see why Luke doesn't know all of that necessarily, but, like, I can see why this would all be Hermes' fault in his eyes. Like, he doesn't know that some of it has to do with Hades and some of it has to do with, you know, all these other big things going on in the world. It actually all has to do with Nico. Like, Luke doesn't know that, but it all kind of stems from the Nico problem. And,
right.
Yeah, so it's all just, like, connected in a weird way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I also wanted to point out, like, super quickly, the hint that what Hermes did as a baby, because we just learned this.
Yeah.
And for him, like, you know, I was only a baby when, and then he gets cut off. And I was like, I know exactly what you did.
We just talked about that.
You made turtle soup.
Right? Pretty funny. Not gonna lie. I did giggle a little bit at that point. Okay, so as they're having this discussion and this fight, Hermes keeps insisting with Luke that he is not allowed to interfere. And he keeps hinting that Luke has this terrible fate looming that cannot be stopped. And in this moment, I got very mad at Hermes because he spends so much of this book being pissed at Annabeth and even a little bit at Percy, too, for not stopping Luke. When he has known all along what was going to happen and did not stop it and did not try to stop it, did not try and guide others to help stop it. Like, he's known this forever and he's just like, I can't do anything. Well, then don't get mad at the 12-year-old and 13-year-old next to you who can't do anything either.
Yeah. I completely agree with that. He should not have gotten mad at Annabeth if he had known all along. Putting that aside, this broke my brain a little bit because if you think about it, this is actually like, I don't want to say I feel bad for Hermes, but but he knew what his son was going to do. He knew at least some part of what was going to happen. And I feel like if he really wanted to stop it, he could. You know, despite the rules and stuff like that, gods do interfere. They do push people across the chessboard. That is literally what they're known for.
Yeah.
So I feel like he could have found a way to avoid at least some of what's happening, like, in this last book. However, because of what happens by the end of the book, the resolution to a lot of the issues, Percy going to Olympus and requesting what he requests, Hermes could have known that that was the end result and therefore knew he couldn't stop Luke from doing it because the world would be a better place if this happened. And if that were the case, that is a lot of responsibility that he is carrying that he's not letting anybody else know.
Which is very true. And never takes
credit for.
Yeah. No, and that is a fair thought that, like, he knows that ultimately this is going to end in all, you know, all this positive whatever. But, like, at that point, you're just saying, like, okay, well, how far ahead do you know and where's the line? Like, where do you draw the line as we can't let this happen, but we're going to let this happen because Kronos is almost back. Like, he is back.
Yeah.
But is not, like, in power yet. Mm-hmm. Like, how far are you going to let this go? I mean, it just, it's
and
hard.
How much did he actually know? Like, how many details did he know? Because he's not the god of prophecy.
Right.
So, how did he know in the first place? Did Apollo tell him? Did he just give him a hint that, like, hey, this kid's gonna grow up to be...
Was it a message he carried?
Yeah. I mean, it very well could have been. He could have read a message that maybe he shouldn't have, but he knows that he couldn't have done anything about it.
Yeah.
It's just... kind of, you know...
It's a very frustrating situation for all parties.
Yes,
including us.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so Percy watches this happen after they have their little fight, and Luke basically says, like, you're not telling me anything, you're not giving me anything to work with, I'm done, like, I'm out. And he marches out of the house, and that's when Percy wakes up. So Percy comes back to the world, and... he can feel himself getting angrier by the second. Clearly, when it comes to this vision, he's getting out of it what Prometheus wanted, which is Luke has been wronged by his father. Because that's more or less how Percy steps out of this vision and is like, this isn't fair. Luke didn't deserve this. You know, why didn't Hermes help him? All this time that Annabeth and Talia and Luke have been on the run with all these monsters chasing him, Hermes never helped that either. Like, why didn't he help? And so as Percy is just getting angrier and angrier, Grover kind of steps in and says, Percy, this Prometheus, you're doing exactly what Prometheus wants. And it just gives Percy a second to kind of step back, and he, you know, he kind of rights himself just a little. He still feels all of that anger, but, like, he doesn't let it overwhelm him, where I feel like he could have, in this moment, he could have just, like, let it go. But that's what keeps Percy from crossing the line, is, like, Grover and Annabeth are always kind of there to say, like, hey, remember what we're doing and why we're doing it and why it's worthwhile, and, yeah. So I just thought it was a good moment for them. We don't get a lot of Grover moments, but this one's kind of special.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a little sad that Grover kind of does take a step back a little bit in these books. I mean, it's so interesting because he's grown so much a little bit off page.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. He's, you know, practically a general right now for the satyrs and the nymphs and the dryads and the naiads and all of that. And he's matured so much and he's doing all of these things. And yet, he is there for comic relief a little bit. Like, he doesn't always get to step up in the same way that Percy and Annabeth do. He does sometimes, yeah, but not as often. And that's kind of one of the things that I hope the show will change, that we'll get a little bit more Grover, that he'll be a little bit more consistent throughout the series.
I think that's really fair, and something to really hope for, because, yeah, you're right, like, the show will have the opportunity to let us see Grover in doing what he does. Like, he doesn't necessarily have to be with Annabeth and Percy for us to see him. We can take 5-10 minutes an episode and see what Grover is up to. As long as it ties into the main story at some point, it'll be worthwhile. So I think you're right. Yeah, that'll be a really fun, interesting way they can kind of expand the books for us, for sure. Okay, so after Grover and Percy kind of have their moment, Prometheus plops this big jar on the table, and it's Pandora's jar, aka Pandora's box, but apparently that was all a big, like, thing, and he doesn't know how the box thing got started, because it was always a jar. So, Pandora's jar, and the only thing left in Pandora's jar is hope, because as we know, Pandora's box was opened and all the demons were released into the world, but hope, or I believe it's Elpis, is the spirit that's left. Hope stayed with humanity, which is why it's still in the jar. So the only thing left in the jar is hope. And if Percy decides that he wants to surrender and abandon all hope, he's going to open the jar, it will release Elpis, and Prometheus will know, and he'll tell Kronos, and they will basically march straight to Olympus and take it over and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I, first of all, the whole jar box thing is just hilarious.
Yeah.
And I liked the interplay there with, like, Prometheus being like, I don't know how that got started, and my poor girl Pandora was, you know, she wasn't a bad person, and the gods did this again. Like, he's laying it on so thick. Like, this is why, you know, all of this is another reason, Percy, why you should be on my side. And it's a valiant effort.
Yes.
On Prometheus' part.
Yeah, and that's my takeaway with this, is that what I really like about Luke and Prometheus' side is that they're not wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They are not wrong, full stop. The Olympian gods are terrible. All of them. And I mean, as we've been doing the deep dives, we've realized all of them are pretty terrible. They've done pretty terrible things. Even the ones that were like, oh, you know, he's a little bit better, she's a little bit better than some of the other ones, they've still all killed people and done terrible things. But that doesn't make Kronos' side right.
Right.
And that's the big point that I think needs to be driven home. Kronos' side is not right or good or the answer to all of their problems just because the Olympian gods are bad.
Yeah.
Obviously, Percy's going to kind of find option C here, but it's the thing that Luke isn't seeing. You know, he goes, okay, the Olympian gods need to be stopped. Kronos is offering me a solution to stop them. He's the only option I can see, therefore I am going to take it. And a lot of people on that side put blinders on. They go, okay, Well, Cronus isn't great either, but he'll be better than the Olympian gods. Or at least he's not the Olympian gods. And it's like, no, you have to look at the whole picture.
They're like, why don't we, you know, the Olympian gods have had their chance and they've done terribly, so why not give Cronus a try? Well, because Cronus is real bad. Like, I get the motivation to want to punish the gods, to want Cronus to take over and to give them a taste of their own medicine here. Like, I understand the motivation, but Cronus is just not going to do things to better humanity or anyone other than Cronus. And they all seem to believe that he's going to do right by them. And I, again, we've talked about this. I don't think they can trust that.
Yeah.
It's very complicated. So, it basically, after he gives Percy Pandora's jar, Prometheus takes his white flag and his buddies, and they all head back, and that's pretty much the end of the chapter. There's a lot going on in this chapter, and all they're doing is talking. But it's the back and forth with Ethan and with Prometheus that just kind of, you learn more about Percy and you learn more about this war and everything that's going on. Okay, so that pretty much finishes up our discussion, but we still have our favorite quotes and favorite moments to go. So, I will start with my favorite quote because I already basically told you all my favorite quote. And it was Percy talking to Ethan and he says, "So I saved your life and you repaid me by raising Cronus." That's fair, because I just loved it so much. It's pure Percy sass, and I love it so much. Okay, Karen, what was yours?
Percy was on fire this chapter, because this next one is, like, one of those pivotal Percy badass moments. He's talking to Prometheus, and he says, "I'll give you a deal. Tell Cronus to call off his attack, leave Luke Castellan's body, and return to the pits of Tartarus. Then maybe I won't have to destroy him." Ooh! I love this version of Percy.
Yeah, it's fantastic and so much fun to read. Love it, love it. Okay, and then we have our favorite moments. Again, mine was Percy refuting Ethan Nakamura's justification for his actions one by one like a tennis match, because it was just really, really fun to watch and read and all that. So, what was yours?
Mine was Prometheus's calm demeanor, his rational points, his true hope that Percy will see reason and choose the outcome he believes will have fewer casualties, because I think he was really genuine in that moment. Even if he was trying to be a little manipulative, I think he really thought that Cronus's side was the better side. And yeah, his whole personality, I just think, is a really interesting character to have. Yeah. In the middle of everything else.
I think so, too. He was definitely a really interesting person to have walk into the story right now.
Yeah.
Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to 3 other podcasts. If you like revisiting your favorite canceled and cult classic shows, consider tuning into Rewatchable for in-depth discussions about Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, Angel, and many more. We also have Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with our favorite creators. And lastly, we also have Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which has previously discussed every episode of the show, contains exclusive interviews, and they will be covering the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews really help others to find us, and that would be awesome. You can leave us questions or comments or ideas for content and episodes you might want to hear in any of these places, and we will keep an eye out. We love hearing from you, so please reach out. We do have some feedback this week. I will throw it to Karen for a message from Edward.
Yes, Edward wrote in through email and says, "Hi, Prophecy Radio. Did you know that in the PJO series, Clarice is both described as a blonde or a brunette, depending on the book?" And says, "I don't know the exact quantity of time she's described as blonde or brunette, but she's described as both." And I did look into this. This is true. Like, in the first book, I think she's described as a brunette. And then in Titan's Curse, was it? She's described as a blonde or something like that. And some people kind of interpret this as maybe she has, like, dirty blonde hair or something. But I think that's interesting. When we're done with this series, the first 5 books, we want to, one of our ideas is to go look at that Tumblr that kind of collated all of the mistakes and inconsistencies in the books and just go through it and see what people have found, because I find that to be pretty interesting. So hopefully we'll be talking about this again at some point.
Yeah, it's one of those... It could either, A, be one of those things where Rick forgot what color hair she had, and in his head at the time he was like, it's kind of like a blondish brown, I'm just gonna call it blonde, and wrote it down. But she's also a girl, and we like to change our hair colors.
Yeah.
So she could have just dyed it blonde. That's and he true. Decided, you know what? Clarice felt like being a blonde in this book, so she's going to be a blonde. You never know. So I think that's fun. We also have a message from Nicholas.
Nicholas wrote in on Twitter and said, this is a minor thing I was reminded of from the quiz from last week, but oddly, Neptune's never appeared in any of the books, and yet he's the only Roman god with their name in a book title. I guess that's representation enough, but I'd have liked to see the differences, not just hear the fear. And I don't think I realized this. Like, I don't remember Heroes of Olympus well enough to, like, you know, be able to be like, oh yeah, he for sure wasn't in there. But it is super interesting that his name is in the title of one of the books, and yet we never technically see Neptune.
That is really interesting.
Yeah. That's another fun fact to say for, like, trivia or something.
Right, yeah. Again, we'll have to kind of, like, keep track of that, because we're gonna step away from the Percy series after this and do...
King Chronicles.
Thank you guys for reaching out. We love hearing from you guys. That's good fun. Okay, so next week... We kind of have a fun idea for an episode in store, and we're really hoping everything shakes out, but we want to talk about fan art next week. So if you have any thoughts or opinions on fan art and want to share them with us, feel free to reach out. We'd love to hear from you guys for our feedback section.
Or your favorite Percy Jackson artist.
Yes,
sure,
absolutely.
Share them with us.
Tag them in, you know, let us know who your favorites are, because we are going to be looking this week for some new favorites. Because I can't say I spend a lot of time looking at it, but I know good fan art, like, I know what I like when I look at fan art. So it's going to be fun kind of digging through the... massive amount of Percy Jackson fan art that's out there and find the ones we like. So, yeah, we don't want to miss anybody good. And we're not sure yet exactly what's going to be going on with this episode, but we're hoping to maybe have a special guest or do a giveaway or something fun. So make sure to tune in and you'll find out all our secrets that aren't really secrets. They're just things we are not sure of yet.
Yeah. Secrets even from us.
All right, but until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.